Emily Wilkins Poole, you went to Africa at what age?
I was 21, I believe, 21, 20, 22. I was turning 22 that year.
And it sounds like a fairly audacious thing, but there's some reasons that I know that you need to illuminate to everybody. Talk briefly about your uncle and his experiences.
So, yeah, actually, in my family, multiple members have spent different times in different countries in Africa. So my uncle was, my uncle Carl Wilkins was in Rwanda through the genocide. So their family would always come back and stay with us during their breaks when they'd come home for a month each year. They'd stay with my grandparents or with us, and we'd get to see our cousins. So I always grew up with kind of that exposure to different African countries. My dad actually worked in Zambia for a bit during his, or Zimbabwe, I think a little of both, during his medical school time. So yeah, there was some of that inspiration and familiarity going in.
And I guess just to dispel it, since Carl infamously was there during the most intense part of the Rwandan genocide, and true, that had been, you know, what, almost 15 years or so before you went, did that still cause fear or concern or apprehension that 21-year-old Emily would run off to Africa?
I think I heard so many inspiring stories, and I had such a view of those different cultures that there was just so much to learn and so much beauty there. So I didn't have that fear. Of course, you know, once I got there, I think the kind of culture shock and being thrown into a language that I didn't understand, and a lot of cultural things that I didn't understand, and of course the pain and suffering side, those things became, that's kind of when it hit me. But beforehand, I guess I was 21 and a little bit naive, and also had been exposed to a lot of really beautiful stories coming out of various countries in Africa.
So knowledge in that case is comfort in a certain way, isn't it?
Yeah, yep.
So as you went there at age 21, and you've already alluded to the fact that many members of your family have been involved with Africa, what were some of your reasons? Was it your own voyage of discovery? Was it your own desire to give back? What was motivating you?
Well, a few different things. My school, Walla Walla University, had a program where you could volunteer, take a year out, and you would actually even receive experiential credit for a year serving in some role. And then the other piece was that I was on the track to do PA school. And in order to apply to PA school, you need to have 2,000 hours of clinical care. So I had done quite a bit of the clinical care. I was doing it here in the States as a phlebotomist and medical assistant. But those hours also counted towards my 2,000 hours. So I received a lot of those hours being in that little hospital.
Obviously, you are already experienced in some medical procedures. Nevertheless, as you've already illuminated really well in the book, once you got to Africa, there were no limits or rules or anything. Weren't you simply there to do whatever you humanly could at any moment?
The thing that I was really grateful for was that I was always paired with a Chadian local nurse. So even though I would work night shifts in this hospital, I was working alongside another Chadian nurse who was very well trained, and they're also just so familiar with the diseases and circumstances that are happening there in that country. So in that way, I was never alone. The things that I was thrown into were like starting IVs, and, you know, I had a little bit of needlework experience, of course, drawing blood and things like that, but it would definitely teach me also the language barrier, being paired alongside somebody who is a native speaker. So yeah, I was definitely secondary to them, but being alongside them, they just often needed more hands. They were just short on hands.
So then you did get involved with delivering babies and surgery and all kinds of things, didn't you?
Yes, I was working alongside them, getting to scrub in times to assist mostly. But delivering lots of babies there. I only delivered a couple, you know, where I was catching the baby, and I always had somebody alongside. But those experiences, of course, now I have two kids of my own. And yeah, those were my first births to watch. And that was super inspiring.
So many things that you've communicated well in the book about yourself that I want to talk about a couple. The first is what comes across as a fearlessness. Have you always been a fearless kid ever since you were a little kid, whether it was, you know, running around and not worrying about scraping your knee or learning the harp at an early age or anything else?
My dad and mom say that I was like that as a kid, and it's fun now because I have my own two kids who are also fearless. And they said that, at that age, and of course all through high school and college, I kind of had a very I wanted to experience a lot of different things. I wanted to understand different people's experiences. And I think it's really special that when you're young, you kind of have that eagerness. And I still hope to always retain that. But of course, you know, you go through certain things and you learn lessons and you're more careful in certain ways. So yes, age has maybe tamed me a little bit. But I think as a kid, I always loved to be exposed to new things. My dad, one time I hitchhiked home from college, and that just about, that was probably the most angry I've ever seen him, because he said, "Emily, that is just not safe." And, you know, of course, in hindsight, I'm like, yes, that is just not safe. But I just had like these pictures of humans that were so good. And I still believe there's so much good out there. But now I'm 35, and I definitely know would never allow my child to hitchhike.
Well, you were at the time you were hitchhiking back from college was kind of the last moment of a golden age of hitchhiking. So we can probably I would give you a pass on that one.
My dad didn't get a pass.
And then the other is your honesty that comes forward in your book, that you seem to have no illusions. You seem to greet everything with an openness and a willingness just to take it for what it is. Talk about how you were raised and how you grew up that way.
My parents were always wanting to expose us to different service opportunities and ways that you could use skill sets that you had for other people. So that definitely was something growing up. Our church would do different service things, you know, soup kitchens and that kind of thing. I just, especially as I moved through that experience, I recognized that our judgment calls of cultures and people and things that we don't know much about are so often wrong. Like, we make these snap judgments. And every time I've gotten closer to somebody's story, or I've taken time to read a book about an experience that I've never been through, I just feel like my judgment falls away, and I have so much more empathy. That to me was probably one of the biggest lessons, is that I thought I knew maybe some things going into Chad, and I learned that poverty, for example, you know, the fact that the kids aren't always wearing shoes. Well, they often actually do have shoes. Some of them would have shoes, but they wouldn't want to wear them because they could just run around, you know. And then other times there are other needs that are really more pressing. And I think healthcare, really the lack of access to healthcare, what I saw as the deepest poverty, some of those poverties. Whereas the fact that we had dirt floors in our houses was really not, it didn't end up being the piece of poverty that I originally would have thought, oh my goodness, it's just a dirt house, you know, versus some of the other things that seemed much deeper.
Several of places in, well, many places in the book, African Rice Heart, are so intense. I mean, so many intense things you describe, and specifically one where you describe where you witness a child being beaten really fairly furiously by an adult for disrespecting, and your ambivalence of whether you should stand aside or interfere. Talk about that, a little more about that experience.
Yeah, I think, like, you know, if I were to see that here in my own culture, of course, I would step in, you know, I think immediately. And it's just, I felt this, this lack of understanding. And so I think I felt that over there a lot, where it was like, I didn't fully understand everything that was happening, but I knew that something at the core of it didn't feel right. And so sorting out, you know, when was the right time to step in. I mean, this was his uncle who was giving him a spanking, like, but what I would consider much more of a spanking, more of a beating. And so when do you step in a moment where you don't understand the culture fully? That was definitely earlier on in my experience. Those are really conflicting feelings for me. And especially with the language barrier, I think you're constantly, I remember asking the Jolie and Samity, asking them about that, and saying, like, you know, why, you know, why would he get that being he? And they kind of said, you know, well, that's just, it's respect. You know, respect is such a big thing there in their culture. And, you know, they are really, the children are extremely respectful in so many ways. In fact, when a child enters a room of adults, the child has to go around and greet each adult with a handshake or a kind of a nod, and goes to each adult before they get busy in the room and go about their play. Like, you don't just ignore an adult when you come into their presence. So there's certain cultural things that are really beautiful, but I guess that moment I was like, something about this just is so wrong. This would, I would, in a flash in my own culture, I would be saying, that's abuse. Like, you're hitting that child really, really hard. And, you know, so it was, those things were hard to process.
Nevertheless, they came at a, you know, at a developmental crucial time in your life. How has that maybe helped you through life since? Because now we and the whole world face difficult decisions and challenges. And what maybe have you taken away from that?
The idea of listening first has become really important to me before judging. The idea, you know, that I don't know the full story and that there's more to listen. Those pieces have really carried with me. I found myself leaning towards mercy and less towards judgment than ever before, simply because I've gone through experiences where I learned something and it changed my mind about something. That's probably one. I decided through that experience, I didn't go to PA school, Vern. I just had such a challenging experience in that hospital. And I realized about myself, like, I don't think I want to be in charge of people's lives. And so I actually ended up not going to PA school, even after I'd been accepted and had all the hours and everything. I even had an apartment reserved. So in many ways, that experience there in Chad completely shaped the direction of my life.
And that does answer that thing that I'd wondered, because with all of that medical tradition in your family, and then you went off to be a writer, right?
Yeah, I went actually and did an MFA in creative writing with an emphasis in nonfiction at Antioch University in LA, and that was a 2-year experience, and I just loved that experience so much. And I worked in writing a couple years and then moved back here to Spokane or to Walla, a couple other places. But once I had my own kids, I started photographing more. And I think this period of my life where I have young children, it's a lot harder to get mental space to write. Like, I just am constantly interrupted. Whereas photography, you know, you can be interrupted in the middle of editing and get right back to it. And you haven't missed a thing. Whereas writing, you just need blocks of time to process, because writing is thinking. So much of writing is thinking.
And then Africa, which of course is so far away and foreign, obviously, to most of us, and yet you've experienced it by being there. And then we experience all the things going on in Africa that are reported in the news, certainly the despots, the leaders and the political situations there. And then, of course, more recently in northern Africa, the horrendous capturing of entire groups of school children and all mm-hmm. of that. How are you able to perceive Africa differently by having been there than I can?
You know, I think those things break my heart. And I by no means think, you know, even in processing all these things, it's not that I can't recognize something that's wrong, you know, but it just, by being there and seeing, you know, that village life, how a village works, how you care for your neighbor in a way that is so direct. It's helped me to see the light that also might be there alongside some of these really dark things and things that are calling for change. You know, it's not that we would say, oh, but it's just how it is, you know, there in Chad. It's not that. It's just that it's really helped me see humans as a mixture of things, just like I am, you know, a mixture of bad qualities and maybe some good qualities. And so it's just not black and white when I think of some of these situations.
What do you sometimes think relative to our government and our country and our civilization How should we be treating and dealing with Africa maybe differently than we do?
You know, I think that is just such a complex, complex question, and I think the biggest thing that I would hope is that we would continue to come together and listen and learn from each other. And you know, I really, my hat is off often to these people who dedicate their lives to some of these challenging things, famine and some of the other, you know, human rights issues. That is just, it's not a simple fix. It's not just, oh, well, let's just do this and it'll fix it. There's so many factors and cultural things that can take a long time to change. And so I my hat is off to people who are in the thick of those efforts.
And so you've experienced them from all sides and brought us this lovely book, African Rice Heart. It came out 10 years ago. And has it then kind of quieted down, or do people still discover it from time to time?
Still from time to time. Now that I'm photographing people, once in a while, people will inquire for photographs and they'll say, oh, and I've read your book. And that's always, I always think, wow, you know a lot about 21-year-old Emily that most people don't know right off the bat. But yes, it's definitely like, you know, it's definitely quieted down, and it's been a whole decade. Still, it was really fun to go back through now that you've been airing this and just kind of reflect again. And I know I'm going to do that my whole life, because so many of the lessons continue to apply. And now that I have my own family, that family in Chad continues to inspire. Once in a while, when my kids come to our bed in the middle of the night and we're all crammed, you know, in one bed, and I'm thinking, well, this is just like Chad when everybody's sleeping on those big mats. And, it's always going to be with me, always.
Nice. Emily Wilkins Poole, the author of African Rice Heart. Well, it's been a treat for us, for treat for me to re-encounter it. And so we'll continue to enjoy this book for the remaining episodes. So thanks a lot. Appreciate that.
Thank you so much, Vern. I've just really appreciate you, and this has been a great experience.